Hi, thanks for listening to one of our Sunday talks from the Center for Spiritual Living in Midtown Atlanta. If this is your first time listening to one of our talks, we certainly hope you enjoy it. But if you're a regular listener to our podcast, we would like you to consider contributing to our center. It's easy to do. All you have to do is go on our website, and it's easy to find the button and make a contribution. That will allow us to continue bringing these talks to you on a regular basis in the future. Once again, thanks for listening.
Get that out of the way from the tall guy. Take the opening, Doug. Very nice. So how's everybody doing with the traffic? Okay. Everybody smile through this week in the traffic? Anybody lose their cool? I did on Monday. I partially uncurled my fist once, but only to someone who desperately deserved it. We have a very spiritual week. We have the Christian Palm Sunday today and Easter next week. I'll be speaking. Passover starts tomorrow. It goes for about a week. But this morning I want to start with one of my favorite stories. I haven't told this for years from the platform. And it's a story about a man who was involved in a terrible traffic accident, and he dies. Not the way you thought a favorite story would start, is it? But okay. Anyway, after some unknown amount of time, he wakes up, and he's in a very pleasant room, sort of a cross between a hospital room and a hotel room. Very nice, and the sun's streaming through the window. It's a beautiful day. He's in a comfortable bed, and he's wearing a white gown. And sitting over by the window is an elderly man with a white robe, just like his, with a long white beard and a beautiful smile on his face. So as soon as the man in the bed opened his eyes, the old man says, "Good, you're awake. I'm St. Peter. Welcome to heaven." And the man said, "Really? I'm in heaven?" And St. Peter says, "Oh yeah, everybody goes to heaven. We just spread those hell rumors to keep the Baptists and the Catholics in line." That really is his. He said, "That's not the story. That's just the story." So he says, "By the way, I'm going through your paperwork here, and I see that you didn't belong to any religion when you were down on earth. So why don't you let me show you around, you can see what we have to offer, and decide where you want to stay." So St. Peter let him out, and they went around, and they went into a long hallway that had these doors, closed doors, lined as far as the eye could see. And St. Peter went over to the first door, and he opened it just about this far, and he signaled for the guy. And the guy looked in there, and he could see there was this crowd of happy, well-dressed people, and they were singing hymns, and they were drinking sweet tea, and they all had Bibles that they were waving around. And St. Peter whispered to him, "Those are the Baptists." And he closed the door. So they go a little farther down the hall, and he opens the door, just a sliver, and there were all these people sitting at picnic tables, and they were drinking beer and playing bingo, you know, laughing. And St. Peter whispered, "Those are the Catholics." And he closes the door. So a little further on, they peek in another door, and there are these huge families, men with several women sitting with them. It looks very, very interesting. And 18, 20 kids around each picnic table, everybody looking very content. And as he opened the door, St. Peter says, "Those are the Mormons." You know? And on they went from door to door, St. Peter whispering, "Those are the Methodists. Those are the Hindus. Those are the Muslims," at door after door. So finally, after he had closed another door, the man looked around and he said, "This is all very interesting, but why are we whispering?" And St. Peter shrugs his shoulder and says, "Because they all think they're the only ones up here." Now, I told that story not to make a point. I told that story to hear you laugh. I did, okay? Because if I had to choose one sound in the world that I love, it would be the laughter of a child, followed closely by the laughter of almost anyone else. I mean, even if you're in a bad mood, hearing that sound will almost always raise your energy up a notch or two. Remember some years ago they had those boxes in a bag, little laughing bag kind of things. You know, they were, you push them, you'd push a button and you'd get this uproarious laughter there, and it was almost contagious. Well, I know some of you miss props from David. So anyway, I got this from my wife, but this is kind of what it was. It's sort of a, you know, somebody would just all of a sudden do this. And it would just go and go, and people, in spite of themselves, would start laughing. Now, there's other sounds in here I'm not going to do. This is not my thing. There's a poem that most of you have probably heard, and you don't know where it came from. You've heard part of it anyway. And this poem, I'm going to read part of it to you. It was written in 1954 by a woman whose name was Ella Wheeler Wilcox. And she was known for years as the poet laureate of New Thought, of metaphysical teachings. And she wrote all sorts of positive, upbeat, very mediocre poetry. And most of you have never, has anybody heard of her, heard that name? Probably maybe a couple who were in class, but most of you know. But you may remember this one verse that she wrote. She said, "Laugh and the world laughs with you, weep and you weep alone. For the stodgy old earth has need of your mirth, it has troubles enough of its own." Haven't most of you heard at least part of that? You know, okay? Now, that was 100 plus years ago, 1904. But a contemporary interpretation of that poem would be pretty straightforward. It simply says, if you like to laugh, and you're usually in a pretty good mood, you're going to have lots of people interested in sharing your company. All right? On the other hand, if you're moping around all the time and you're really negative, no one is going to want to be around you except the other people who are moping and negative all the time, because they can't find anybody else who wants to be around them either. That's the way it works. But actually, that's not completely true. You see, negative people don't like to be around other negative people either. They really don't. They just do it because if they can tell their story to the other person, then the other person's obligated to listen to theirs. And they can't get any positive people to listen to their stories for any length of time. Now, personally, I think our biggest problem, by our, I mean the universal our, us human beings, in terms of spiritual growth in today's world, is not that we have lost touch with God. I don't think that's it. And it's not that we don't see the connection between ourselves and other people and all the rest of life. I believe our biggest problem, spiritually speaking, is that we have lost our sense of humor. Anybody agree with that? I really think that's true. Okay? We take God too seriously. We take religion too seriously. We take ourselves too seriously. We take the world too seriously. In fact, I'm convinced that most fundamentalists of every faith, and there are fundamentalists in this too, trust me, have forgotten how to laugh. And if you don't believe me, tune in the 700 Club for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. You'll figure out exactly what I mean. Now, it's kind of sad if you think about it, because as someone once said, Jesus probably had a great sense of humor to be invited to all the great places and dinners and stuff that he was. And the Jewish people were pretty funny. Okay, Jesus was Jewish. A lot of comedians are Jewish. In fact, I went online and I pulled up a list, including the great Dom Rickles, who passed this week. And I'm going to give you a very short list and see if you've heard of some of these people, Jewish comedians on them. Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, Joan Rivers, Jack Benny, Groucho Marx, Rodney Dangerfield, John Stewart, Billy Crystal, Gilda Radner, Elaine Boozler, Jerry Seinfeld. I could go on and on and on. It's amazing when you look at the names. And even though there aren't too many funny stories coming out of the Muslims nowadays, if you go back in history to the Sufis, which is an offshoot of Muslim, the poet Hafez, about 800 years ago, had a tremendous sense of humor. If you ever read the interpretations of his poem, they're very, very funny. Now, the Dalai Lama, I have him on my Facebook page, and almost every picture you see of the Dalai Lama, he's laughing. If you've ever seen him in real life speaking, he loves to laugh, okay? But for the most part, mixing religion and humor is a very touchy thing right now in a lot of parts of the world. You have to be very careful who you tell jokes to, especially if the joke has religious undertones or anything else that might offend somebody. For example, you may have heard the one about how many people of a certain religion it takes to change a light bulb. Anybody ever hear that? Pull up online, a few of you. Okay, let me read a few of these to you for the ones who haven't. How many of X does it take to change a light bulb? Pentecostals. Any Pentecostals here prior? Okay. 10. 1 to change the bulb and 9 to pray against the spirit of darkness. Presbyterians. None. Lights will go on and off at predestined times. Roman Catholic. No light bulbs, candles only. Baptists. I know we got a few. Okay. At least 15. one to change the light bulb, and three committees to approve the change and decide who brings the potato salad. Episcopalians, I like this one, three. One to call the electrician, one to mix the drinks, and one to talk about how much better the old bulb was. Mormons, five. One man to change the bulb and four wives to tell him how to do it. Lutherans, none. Lutherans don't believe in change. Amish, what's a light bulb? Then you have religious scientists, okay? Only one, but the light bulb has to be really ready to change. Last night I was at dinner with my niece up in Suwannee. My wife and I were up there. Beautiful, wonderful people. And they're very, very Christian, but in the good way, okay? Just very generous, nice people. And she's always asked me what my topic is for the next day and stuff. And she says, well, you've probably heard this. But she said, and the Lord said to John, come forth, and I will give you eternal life. But he came in fifth, and all he got was a toaster. Think about it. Now, believe it or not, some people from these various religions would be insulted, aghast, by these harmless bits of humor. But in my point of view, any spiritual teaching that doesn't know how to laugh at itself is not very spiritual at all. Not at all. Because, as someone once said, life is too important to be taken seriously. And if that's true about life, it's twice as true about spirituality. In fact, that's one of the things I love about this teaching. I love coming to a place that actually encourages laughter and applause and irreverence. I always think of this teaching as irreverence, and I consider that a good thing. When I took over from Kennedy Schultz in 1999 over at the Woodruff Auditorium, I think some of you, how many people here knew Kennedy, my teacher? A bunch of you, it's great. A couple of guys came up to me the Sunday that I first came out after Kennedy had retired, and they gave me this beautiful baseball hat. I like to wear baseball hats. And on the back, it has my name, the Reverend Paul Gagne. I don't feel very reverent, but anyway. And on the front, it says, Irreverent Reverend. How about this hat? I have it sitting on a Buddha back at my house. So, anyway. If this power we call God is as intelligent and as creative and as loving as we believe it is, then it certainly knows how to laugh at itself. I've got a cartoon on a special bulletin board at home, and it's this little guy who's naked from the waist up with glasses, clouds around him, and there's a podium in front of him, and there's a man behind there with a big white beard, big smile on his face. It's supposed to be God. And God's leaning on the podium, and he says, no, that's not a sin either. My goodness, you must have worried yourself half to death. I mean, if we believe that God is everything, then God created humor. Right? Okay. So for any of us who plan on being around this teaching for a while, humor is a pretty good thing to practice for us to practice too. Now, let's get into the nuts and bolts of this a little bit. Being able to laugh is closely tied to our ability to feel our connection with Spirit, because being able to laugh requires us to be open. It requires us to be open. A good sense of humor requires us to listen. It requires us to think, and it requires us to feel not only what's in our own heart, but also to feel what other people are feeling. It requires empathy and understanding. It requires namaste, where the spirit in me, the God in me, recognizes the God in every other person. But being open and trusting is not something that most of us are good at least not as adults. Now, we may not remember it, but it was very easy to be open when we were children. We were very trusting when we first arrived on the planet, okay? We were open to everything. If you go to a playground with young kids, or if you take sort of sneak out of here while I'm talking and go into the kids' room over there, you know, and you see these kids running around. We won't let them run down in there, but because they aren't allowed to. But, you know, these kids are laughing, and they're laughing, but they're not laughing. Yeah, sort of. That's the theory, right, Jeannie? Anyway, they aren't laughing at a joke. They aren't laughing at anything in particular. They're laughing simply because they're running, or they're playing, or with their friends, or because it's recess, or whatever it happens to be. They're laughing at the sheer joy of being alive. That's what they're laughing at. But at some point, a lot of us forgot how to do that. So today we think we need to have a reason to laugh. We need to go to a comedy club, you know, to have someone do it, which is how the comedians make a living, which is a good thing, right, Bob? Okay? We think something out there has to affect us in such a way that we feel laughter is an appropriate response. I mean, if you walk around laughing for no reason, they will try to put you away. Okay? They really, really will, all right? Or at least they will avoid you. People will do that. That's why we find ourselves, as a race of beings, involved in the pursuit of happiness instead of just being happy. That's what we do. We pursue happiness instead of creating it or accepting it. We search high and low for the joy in life instead of recognizing where it already is in the child in us. Okay? In that original trusting spirit that we were born with. Every single one of us. Now, there's one school of thought that maintains that joy and happiness are two different things. Anybody remember a woman by the name of Eyanla Van Zandt? Very, very interesting woman. She wrote several books, but the book I really love of hers is called One Day My Soul Just Opened Up. Beautiful title. And in this she says, I'm going to read a short paragraph to you, so just listen for a second. She says, joy is an internal process grounded in the knowledge of spiritual truth, the ability to trust the wisdom of the divine, and faith in the perfect process of life. Happiness, on the other hand, is generally a mental and emotional response to some temporary external stimulation. So she says, I love that, she says, joy is emotional stimulation in response to spiritual inspiration, while happiness is mental inspiration in response to physical stimulation. That's kind of an interesting perspective. What she's saying is, when we laugh at a joke, for example, we may feel happy for a few minutes, especially if the jokes just keep on coming. Or when someone tells us that we're smart, or that we're funny, or that we're attractive, we may feel happy then too. But that kind of happiness only lasts for a certain length of time. It can come and it can go. But when we find ourselves being able to laugh and smile spontaneously, simply because of the state of mind that we feel in here all the time, no matter what's going on out there, that's when we know that we've arrived. That's when we know that we have returned to our original childlike state of joy. Not childish, childlike. A very different thing. Of course, many of the spiritual teachers, the great spiritual teachers, don't make that fine of a distinction. They see joy and happiness as one and the same thing. But something they all do agree on is that if this feeling is going to last, whatever we call it, it has to come from in here. It has to come from in here, not from out there. More than 2,000 years ago, Aristotle said, happiness depends upon ourselves. Very, very simple. And Gandhi, the great Gandhi, said, happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. Are in harmony. That means being happy, or being joyful, or being positive, or being optimistic, whatever term you want to use, comes from a number of decisions that we have to make in a certain way. In other words, laughter may be an automatic response, but it can only come automatically from a consciousness that's open to seeing the humor in the world. On the other hand, all the other stuff, anger, depression, negativity, those are also automatic responses for some people that start out as a choice. But those choices come from a decision to embrace a consciousness that only sees the dark side of the world. That's where they come from. You see, what comes into our mind is not always under our control. It really isn't. There's a lot of very sad, tragic, unfortunate stuff going on in the world. We look at this week as an example, but we could pick almost any day, anywhere. There are also a lot of people out there who are addicted to drama, some of whom we are related to, who are always trying to keep themselves and everyone else up to date on the latest bad news. We have those people around us at work, all around us. Even if you turn off the news, and I know some of you have, even if you stop looking at the internet and try not to be around negative people, some of this stuff still seeps in. You can't help that. But just because it gets into our mind doesn't mean we have to keep it there. Keeping it in our mind is a choice. Only we choose what stays in our consciousness, and only we choose what goes. Now, here's something else to think about. Angry or unhappy people are not just those people who have been treated badly by the world or had something bad happen to them, okay? Angry or unhappy people are people who have either chosen to be angry or unhappy, which most people are smart enough not to do, or they are people who have not actively chosen to be happy and joyful in their life no matter what, which is something that a lot of people don't do. I mean, the truth is, if we want to be miserable, if you want to be miserable, I got people you can talk to. They will help you, I promise. The world has a whole lot of different ways to support our misery. And if you want it, the law of attraction will ensure that you get more than your share if that's what you want. But if we're always ready to find the humor in every person, every situation, or every single experience that we encounter, the universe will provide us with an abundance of opportunities to smile. Whether it's a sunset, a symphony, or your sweetie, any of which work very, very well. Now, another reason for us to laugh and smile on a regular basis is the benefit it has on our health. Numerous scientific studies have shown that people who describe themselves as happy and optimistic live longer. All right? In fact, laughter actually changes our body chemistry. Did you know, this is fascinating when I heard it, that tears of joy and tears of sadness are chemically different. They're chemically different. Our blood changes, our blood chemistry changes for the better when we are happy and positive. Our blood turns less acidic, so it stops eating away at the parts inside our body. Our digestion is better, we sleep better. And none of this is a surprise to anyone here, but it goes even further than that. Back in 1964, there was a man by the name of Norman Cousins. Anybody familiar with that name? He was the editor of a magazine that was very popular at the time called the Saturday Review. And he was the editor of that magazine for more than 30 years. Anyway, he was diagnosed at one point, at the height of his career, with a severe and life-threatening form of arthritis. So he wrote a book about it later, about his illness and his healing, which I'll talk about in a second. And the book is called The Anatomy of an Illness as Perceived by the Patient. Okay, it's just referred to as Anatomy of an Illness, but it's as perceived by the patient. He was told by his doctors that he would probably not survive, and even if he did, he would be severely crippled. He was 49 years old at the time. Anyway, to make a long story short, after a week or two of treatment, very aggressive treatment, he became extremely unimpressed by both the toxicity and the poor performance of the medications that they were giving him and by the negative atmosphere of the hospital. He writes all this in the book. So instead of the things that they were giving him, which were unable to stop the pain of the arthritis, even temporarily, he made the personal decision, and I emphasize this is a personal decision, okay? He had himself put on a vitamin C drip in bed with no other medication. Not even aspirin. Nothing. But the most interesting part of all was what he did for himself in addition to that, mentally and emotionally, to change the negative state of mind that he felt the doctors in the hospital were exposing him to. They were good people, but that was just the atmosphere he was in. And here's what he wrote. Let me read his brief story here. He said, "Nothing is less funny than being flat on your back with all the bones in your spine and joints hurting. I needed a new program. A good place to begin, I thought," this is him talking, "was with amusing movies. My friend, Alan Funt," remember him, Candid Camera, okay, the producer, "sent some of his classics, along with a motion picture projector." This is 64, before VCRs or DVDs. "We were even able to find some old Marx Brothers and Three Stooges films. We pulled down the blinds, and we turned on the machine. It worked. I made the joyous discovery that 10 minutes of genuine belly laughter had an anesthetic effect that gave me at least 2 hours of pain-free sleep. When the pain-killing effect of the laughter wore off, we'd switch on the projector again, and frequently it would lead to more pain-free sleep. That's his story. The only problem he ran into was that everyone in his hospital room, all his friends would come and visit, were laughing so hard that it was disturbing the other patients. So he had himself moved to a very nice hotel nearby, which allowed him to get away from the hospital environment. Now, during this whole process, he wasn't abandoning traditional medicine. The doctors took readings of his blood and discovered that his bad cell count dropped measurably after each episode of laughter, and it stayed down. And it stayed down. Now, I've gotten feedback before from people in the medical community. How can you tell people not to take medicine? This was a personal decision on his part, okay? And medical community may argue about how or why this worked. But the bottom line to me is that not only was he eventually healed with no lasting effects, he lived another 26 years. I mean, that's tough to argue. Now, if laughter can help us to heal physically, what should that be telling us about how it might affect the other areas of our life where we have challenges? I can't begin to tell you how many people I have worked with back when I was doing a lot of counseling who need more than anything to remember how to laugh. To remember how to laugh. In fact, that's frequently how I used to end a counseling session. I tell people to remember to laugh. I tell them how beautiful they are when they smile. And I tell them this not only because it might distract them from whatever it is they're worrying about, but because it reminds them that their pain is temporary, that it's all temporary. It reminds them that their laughter is more powerful than whatever it is they happen to be facing. It may even remind them that the world is a truly warm and loving place if they'd only allow themselves to experience it that way. Now, we also need to take more time to laugh at ourselves. And I don't mean laugh at ourselves making fun and criticizing ourselves at our failures or our stupidity, of which we all have an abundance. I mean we should be laughing at how seriously we take things. Money issues, job issues, relationship issues. And we should be laughing with joy at our ability to live and to love and to play, and to create, and to do all these amazing things that we can do. We should be laughing at all the different ways that it is possible for us to enjoy ourselves. We should be laughing with joy at how much we have to offer the world, and how much the world is offering us, whether we allow ourselves to receive it or not. We also need to start using our senses more, start using our eyes and our ears more. We need to look for the humor, actively look for the humor in everything we see, and to listen for the humor in everything that we hear. The funniest comedians in the world, people like Jerry Seinfeld, Jeff Foxworthy, Robin Williams, Ellen DeGeneres, these are not just people who have funny things happen to them. They are not. These are people who live in the same world that you and I live in, with all the crazy stuff going on all around them, who have taught themselves, let me say that again, they have taught themselves to look for something funny in everyday things. In everyday things. And when they find it, they make us laugh. They make us laugh. Now, they do it to make a living. We need to do it to make a life. That's what we need to do, okay? We should do it to create a life worth living. We all have a desperate need to laugh, or we will die. We will, really. Now, our body may keep on moving, you know, for 30 or 40 years. Some people are like that. Our heart may keep on beating, but it will be empty. It'll be empty. And our soul, our spirit, our childlike joy is going to wither away. You know people like this, and so do I. We have been given one day at a time to live and to move and to feel and to create and to express ourselves. But the choice of what to fill that one day with is completely ours. We can fill each day with laughter, or we can fill it with tears. We can fill it with joy, or we can fill it with anger. We can fill it with love, or we can fill it with hatred. We have that ability. So, for any of you, and for me, who haven't yet made up your mind which one of these fillers you prefer, I think today with the traffic and the politics and all the other stuff going on, all right, would be an excellent time to start practicing by putting a smile on your face, even if it's a fake smile, until you remember what it feels like. Until you remember what it feels like. And if we all do that, just the people in this room, the 80 or 90 people in this room, let's see how many people we can make smile simply by seeing us smile today. Notice that. Notice that, okay? Now, they may think we're strange, okay? But I can live with that, personally. I'd much rather be strange than boring, I decided a long time ago. And when they see me smiling, I like having them wonder what I've been up to. That's a nice bonus. Anyway, this is the truth in your life, and this is the truth in mine. And so it is. So it is. Let's take a few moments, close your eyes, and smile. Nobody's looking at you. Don't be self-conscious. And know this with me. Take the ideas that resonate with you. I give you them to you freely. Set aside the others for later. I know that the world is a beautiful, joyful, incredible place. Not just part of the world, not just one country or one town or one certain day or one holiday or whatever it is, but every moment of every day, everywhere. The potential for laughter and joy is always there, even in the midst of the worst tragedy. That doesn't mean we are laughing or accepting the things in life that don't need to exist, like war and poverty and hunger. We are not laughing at that or laughing at anyone. We are laughing at the greater possibility that always exists. We are smiling, recognizing the spirit in every other person. We are laughing at the things that we refuse to make us cry. We're simply being in the presence of life, knowing at our core that there is always something better. As good as it is, it can always be better. As bad as it can always be healed. As sad as it is, there is always love to replace it. So as I know this, I go into my life and I take the things that seem so big and so difficult, whether it's financial or relationship or work, all these things that seem so serious, and I remember that I'm alive. I remember that I am here as a spiritual being with a deep sense of creativity and the ability to love. And as I do this, I see these big monsters that I've created in my mind slowly shrinking and becoming smaller and smaller, and becoming simply something I need to do rather than something I need to overcome. The mountains become molehills, the cliffs become steps, and all of this happens because I now see the beauty and the humor in life. Knowing this, I give thanks for this awareness. I give thanks for the opportunity to think and feel and be open to the world and to other people. I give thanks for all that I have been given and all that I have yet to give. Knowing this, I embrace this truth, I accept it, and I release it into consciousness, letting it be the truth for me from this moment on. Join me in saying, and so it is.